Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast. My name is Steve Vanderark, and I am the creator and editor-in-chief of the Harry Potter Lexicon. I'm also the author of a couple of books about Harry Potter, The Lexicon, which is a kind of an encyclopedic guide to everything in the Harry Potter canon, and also a book called In Search of Harry Potter, where I wander around Britain looking for places similar to the ones in the books. Today we're going to talk a little bit about one of those places, because as I've said, I kind of started this podcast off by taking a copy of the Lexicon book, which is in, you know, it's an alphabetical order encyclopedia, and just looking at some of the entries. And the reason that that inspired this podcast was because as I looked at various entries, I kept thinking of I kept remembering things that I'd done, places I'd been trying to, as I researched Harry Potter and looked into the background of the books and things like this over the past 12 years or something like that. And I kept thinking that it would be great to be able to share so much of these experiences and these things that I've learned with fans in general. And I did that, of course, at the conventions, and so a lot of people have heard me speak there. But now that the films are done and the conventions only happen once a year and not everyone can go there, I kept thinking it'd be great to be able to share some of those things with people in a different way, which is why I started the podcast. I'm excited about the fact that the Harry Potter is kind of exciting again and new and interesting, and people are getting really into the books because of Pottermore mostly, which I did get into finally. Took me a while, but I got into Pottermore. I messed around a little bit in there. Such an amazing website. So much fun to play around. And if you know where I am in Pottermore, if you've friended me and kind of watching my little icon move along there, you realize I haven't even started chapter 2 yet. I've just been too busy to even go so far as to get a wand or get sorted, which is pretty sad. But I hope to get to that soon. In the meantime, just poking around and clicking on things and finding out new information has just been so much fun. I promise I will get further into it. I have friends who keep pestering me and saying, well, how come you're still stuck on chapter 1? And I will get to it. But my first impression is just nothing but positive, just really enjoyable. So if you do get on there, do try to track me down. And ProphecyFrog181 is my username on there. Another new thing that's come along before we dive into Harry Potter canon, as of early this morning, my new book has become available on the Amazon Kindle website. It's the Reader's Guide, the first book of the Reader's Guide series, the Harry Potter Lexicon Reader's Guide series. This one is the Reader's Guide to Book 1, to Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Some of you may know that the Lexicon website itself has Reader's Guides. And I guess the book, the electronic book, the new book, kind of started when I was looking at that and thinking, oh man, this all needs to be updated. Most of that information was written 10 years ago, and it was new and exciting then, but a lot of it is either out of date or incomplete, because in the meantime we've learned so much more, and with all 7 books having come out, we now get this kind of overview. So when I was looking at them, I thought, okay, I need to do some editing. I need to get these up to speed. And the more I looked at it, the more I thought, I really need to come at it completely fresh rather than just at it in place. And so, well, the Reader's Guides on the Lexicon website, of course, are still a wonderful resource. They have lists of all the characters in every chapter and spells and magic items and a lot of notes, which some of which are interesting just because they give you sort of, you might say, a historical perspective on the way that fans were looking at the books at the time, the things we didn't know, the speculations that we had. And so they're a lot of fun to read. But for the book, I actually started fresh. I started going through the book kind of line by line and pulling out information, trivia, connections, looked at the themes as they developed, connected some things in book 1 to later books, which we hadn't been able to do when we first were writing the the reader's guides. So the electronic book is a new, fresh look at the series, and it's fun to kind of look at it as a writer, to look at it and to see each of those details coming out, to see J.K. Rowling's really masterful control of her story. If you look at things in book one and realize that she really did know where things were going, she put details in to really lead us forward into the books. And we, at the time, of course, were desperate to find out new information, and we're trying to interpret and to guess. And only looking back do you realize how much, number one, how much information she was giving us, and how many clues and hints, but also how little she revealed. We're going to talk a little bit more about Chamber of Secrets in a few minutes, and it really becomes clear in there. And it's fun to try to analyze her writing process, and what was she trying to do? How was she trying to present her story in the best way? Because Rowling is very, very, very much interested in having her story, her whole story, come out in the way that she wants it to. She wants it read from the beginning, which is why Pottermore does what it does. So you go through book one, you look for things, you find out, and she puts details in, background details, which no one else obviously could know. We certainly, none of our websites or fan-created resources could ever have that kind of information, because she knows the backgrounds and the story, the behind-the-scenes story of writing the books. So the new book, which is the first one of the series, is A Guide to Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. And I'm in the middle of, and I've said this over and over, reading book two, looking into book two, because I'm actually writing the second reader's guide, the second book in the series, the Harry Potter Lexicon Reader's Guide series. And so we will talk about that, since that's what I'm sort of spending all my time with right now. But you can't look at just one book without looking at the whole series, because each book is, as I've said before, part of one whole story. So if you get a chance to check out the new book, it's on the Kindle, Amazon Kindle library right now. I've already uploaded it to the Barnes & Noble site for the Nook, and I'll be doing other formats as soon as I can get those taken care of. So do check those out. I think you'll find them very, very interesting. As I said, this all started as I picked up the Lexicon book, and I was just looking things through. And so we've been, in this podcast, been sort of looking at some various entries here and there without any particular rhyme or reason. It's just kind of fun to pick out an entry and go, oh, well, that's interesting. And one that struck me, and we're kind of in letter B right now, is the fact that the Budley Babberton, which is the town where Slughorn is discovered or is found by Dumbledore and Harry at the beginning of book six, Budley Babberton, the name doesn't, there is no town called Budley Babberton in Britain, but if you look, there is a town called Budley Salterton, which is located on the south coast of Devon, which is actually very near where Rowling went to university in Exeter, and it's also very near Ottery St. Mary, which is where the borough, we've talked about that a couple of episodes ago, right where the borough is located. So all of these names kind of come from that area of the West Country, which is where Rowling sets quite a significant amount of her story. And I was, if you read the book In Search of Harry Potter, I give quite a long kind of travel memoir of my wanderings through that part of the country and the things that I found. And I didn't actually go to Budley Babberton, but you'll find that on there. There's also a town of Chudley, spelled differently, because some of the town names are translated exactly, but others are kind of variations on the existing town names. So Budley Babberton was one of these towns which was kind of part of Rowling's personal history. Moving into the letter C, and I've there's so many things come out. One of them is Cuthbert Binns. And the name Cuthbert, if you remember, we were talking about that list of the Hogwarts professors. That's where the name Cuthbert comes from. And it's interesting because Binns, we've had some discussions about that amongst fans, whether Binns refers, it's kind of a slang term for binoculars, and whether you imagine him as having very kind of thick glasses. That was somebody's, I thought, interesting comment on that. But the first name, Cuthbert, and I'm just going to read this. This is from the Lexicon book, because the Lexicon book doesn't just contain the same information that's on the Lexicon website. It actually has a lot of background material and sources and things which we don't put on the website itself. And this is what it says for Cuthbert, for the Cuthbert name. St. Cuthbert is a well-known Anglo-Saxon holy man who died in 687. Like Binns, St. Cuthbert didn't stay put, even in death. For the next 400 years, his bones were moved from one place to another until they were finally given a proper resting place in a shrine built in Durham Cathedral. Now, I just find things like that very interesting, fascinating. Whether she chose that name because of that connection or not, who knows? But it's just fun to find those things and just wonder whether when she was looking for a name, she saw that one and went, oh, this will fit. So often there are names like that, which some of them just sound right. A name like Dursley, which she took from a town, actually, which is fairly near where she grew up. She didn't choose it because of anything specifically about the town of Dursley. She just liked that name. And she's even commented that people from Dursley probably are not real happy with her for assigning their town name to those particular characters. And in this case, it could be that she just liked the name Cuthbert. But it's fun to find out that there could be a connection because of the saint who had that name. We're going to talk about Charing Cross Road a little bit. Charing Cross Road, of course, is the location of the Leaky Cauldron in the books. And when I was writing In Search of Harry Potter, Charing Cross Road was one of my big destinations. And my whole goal, of course, was to look for the Leaky Cauldron. I knew as a muggle my eyes might slide right past it, as it says in the books, but that was my goal. I was going to try to find the Leaky Cauldron, at least the entrance to it, somewhere along Charing Cross Road. But before I did that, I realized that there's actually a couple of other Harry Potter references right in that area. Maybe the most important one is Tottenham Court Road, which, if you've been to London, you know that Charing Cross Road and Tottenham Court Road are actually, well, they're kind of the same road. Coming from the intersection with Oxford Street, Tottenham Court Road goes to the north and Charing Cross Road goes to the south. And Tottenham Court Road, of course, is where Hermione apparated Harry and Ron away from the wedding when the Death Eaters attacked. And she went to Tottenham Court Road because that's where she'd been with her parents. But if you realize that Tottenham Court Road is very close to Charing Cross Road, I can easily see why she would have been there, because if she was heading for the Leaky Cauldron, Tottenham Court Road would have been right there. But interesting, Tottenham Court Road is kind of the road in London where you go to the electronics shops. All of the main electronic stores are on Tottenham Court Road, which if you think about it, because of the kind of the disconnect between magic and electronics in the books, you can imagine that one of the reasons that Hermione might have taken Harry and Ron to Tottenham Court Road is the fact that they'd be surrounded by all these electronics, all of these things which could act as kind of interference for anybody using magic against them. And they went to that little all-night cafe. Well, I couldn't find any all-night cafes on Tottenham Court Road. As a matter of fact, there really aren't any small little cafes like that at all. All of the coffee shops on Tottenham Court Road are the big chains like Starbucks and Cafe Nero and things. But so I looked around but couldn't find anything that could be that little all-night cafe. But then I actually did notice on the connecting, on the kind of a side street, once you get off the main Tottenham Court Road, there are actually a number of these little hole-in-the-wall kind of little coffee shops and restaurants and things. And there might have been more on Tottenham Court Road 20 years ago. Now, of course, the big chains have taken over. But when I walked around in there, I remember looking and thinking, number one, this is one of the most non- or anti-magic places you could imagine with all the electronics stores. And then I also was thinking about the fact that Hermione has certain places in London or in the Muggle world which are familiar to her. And the reason would be, as I said, that it's very near to Charing Cross Road. So if you go south from Tottenham Court Road, you go through the intersection with Oxford Street, which is a very, very, very busy intersection. You don't just go trotting across the road there without risking your life. And you go onto Charing Cross Road. And again, Charing Cross Road is a very Muggle road. Very heavy traffic, cars, buses, all hours of the day and night. It's always busy. And there's, interesting, there is no parking. You don't park along Charing Cross Road, which is interesting if you remember that a ministry car took the Weasleys and Harry to buy their things on Tottenham Court Road and dropped them off and said he was going to wait. I don't know where the ministry driver would have found to wait while they went into the leaky cauldron. But if you've been on Charing Cross Road, you know what I mean. This is definitely a very busy Muggle place. Not the kind of place you would expect to find a magical pub. So, you know, being the kind of fanatic about this stuff that I am, I did rustle up a map of London from about 1600 and looked for Charing Cross Road and where, because the Leaky Cauldron was founded in about the mid-1500s by Daisy Dotteridge. And so I was trying to find, okay, where would that have been in 1600s? In 1600s London, what did that area look like? And there was no Charing Cross Road in the 1500s. In fact, that area wasn't even part of London. London was much, much smaller at that time. And that area was actually some open fields where the king's deer roamed. And Charing Cross Road didn't exist. It wasn't built till the 1800s. And so, but St. Martin's Lane was there. You can see St. Martin's Lane on the map. And if you look where Charing Cross Road is, there are a number of paths or small roads that cross through that area. So I can imagine Daisy Dotteridge, finding a kind of an out-of-the-way place, some place that wasn't too, packed full of Muggles, and to set up her pub as a kind of a connection point to Diagon Alley. And interestingly enough, when I was in Leeds, I was walking down the high street, and which is very modern, a very modern city. And I happened to notice a little kind of a opening between some of the very modern buildings, and there was a sign that pointed to a pub. And it was kind of a narrow little passage, and I went through there, and behind all the big fancy modern buildings, there was this little pub, which was built in the 1500s. It had been sort of swallowed up by the modern city, you might say, but it was still there, still in business. And, of course, that immediately gave me the idea of what may have happened with the Leaky Cauldron, that just sort of got swallowed up by the city as the centuries passed. And so when I went down Charing Cross Road, I knew I wasn't looking for, a pub, but I was looking for a door, some sort of an entrance, some sort of a way to find the Leaky Cauldron. And I walked south along Charing Cross Road, and of course, as I was going, the description in the book says that the Leaky Cauldron is between a record shop on one side and a bookstore on the other. So I thought, well, that's a pretty good clue. I should be able to spot it from that. Until I realized that Charing Cross Road, especially the north part, is like the road in London for music shops. They're all over the place. But there was no place where there was a bookstore. It was just all music shops and the little newsstands and things like this. And as I went to the south end of Charing Cross Road, that's the place for bookstores. So every bookstore chain has a shop there on Charing Cross Road. But the bookstore shops are all to the south, and the music shops are all to the north. But as I was walking along, right sort of where the two meet, there's a little sort of a little plaza that kind of off the street. And there's a pub there, and there's tables outside and some umbrellas and things. And in that little alcove, or whatever you want to call it, I found the most amazing thing. There is a door, a black door with no handle, and I kid you not, I'm standing there looking at this thing, and there's like potted palm plant kinds of things on either side of it, so it's not real obvious. But there's this black door with no handle, and overhead is a hanging sign. And there it is, in the middle of Charing Cross Road, this mysterious door. Now, is that, did J.K. Rowling go down Charing Cross Road and look around and say, aha, that'll be the entrance to the Leaky Cauldron? Oh, I doubt it very much. I think it's one of those wonderful, magical, delightful coincidences that the whole thing I discovered when I was researching and traveling around in search of Harry Potter was that those magical coincidences happen over and over. I was astounded at how many times I could get so close to the world of Harry Potter or something that just put me right in that story. And if you go there, if you look, you'll see right there is this door. Now, what's on the other side of the door? I have absolutely no idea. There's no handle, so I couldn't get through. And I've had people ask me, well, you know, did you go to the music shop next door? Because there is a music shop on one side and a bookstore on the other. I mean, they're right on either side of it. And so did you ask? And I said, no, because if I ask, they might tell me what's behind that door, and I really don't want them to do that. To me, that will always be the entrance to the Leaky Cauldron. And so I really don't want to know why it's there, but it is. And what a wonderful moment to stand there looking at this mysterious door halfway down Charing Cross Road. And you might say, well, then, you know, did you find Diagon Alley? And as a matter of fact, I got pretty close to that too, but I'll wait on that. Maybe when we get to the letter D, we'll talk a little bit about Diagon Alley, and I'll tell you some of the things I found. I want to talk about book two, and I don't mean to be stuck in that one, but as I do the research that I do on these things, it just over and over I'm struck with how wonderfully Rowling put her stories together. Remember, I talked a couple episodes ago about the fact that the books have to be seen as one long story. I mean, in the introduction to the Reader's Guide book that I just released, I say it's almost like each book is actually a chapter in one long book. And so you've got these four chapters in the first part of the book, and we talked about the fact that those show Harry kind of turning into a superhero, if you will. He's superhero Harry. And at the end of the fourth chapter, if you will, Harry has become this kind of conventional hero. He's got all these wonderful strengths and abilities that, you know, we are all led to believe, well, maybe he can conquer this dark, the ultimate dark wizard, because he can fly so well, and he's learning all these spells. And then the last three chapters, and I'll start talking about that way a little bit more, these last three chapters, which are the last three books, it's a complete turnaround. Book five takes such a different track. We see all of the things that Harry, that we and Harry think are his strengths, and all of them are ripped away, from his flying ability, his broom is taken away, to his image of his parents when he sees that memory of Snape's, and so many things that were to him what would make him that hero, that strong action figure kind of hero, are all taken away from him in book five. And we talked a little bit about his transformation and the way that Luna steps in and kind of helps that transformation along. And then we get to books six and seven, and that kind of finishes the story. So when we think about the series that way, we don't ever want to lose that perspective when we go into one particular book. So when you look at book two, first question I always ask is, what is the purpose of this particular book in that, or this particular chapter, if you will, in the story? And the purpose of book two is a little bit trickier to tease out, but I think it lies, the answer to that question lies in the fact that the original title, or one of the working titles for book two, was Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. And if we know that, and we try to kind of imagine or work out Rowling's writing process, what was she thinking of with book two when it was going to be that title? If you take book six and that plot and that story and try, just for interest's sake, just try transposing that to book two, What if Book 6 had been Book 2? What if we had gotten that story in Book 2? Well, what would we have gotten? Well, a lot of backstory about Voldemort. We would have been introduced to Horcruxes. We would have been... And the point is that we get that in Book 2. We get backstory of Voldemort. We get Horcruxes. And don't for one second think that Horcruxes were sort of tacked in Book 6. If you go to Book 2 and you read what Dumbledore's conversation with Harry after he gets back and he's got the destroyed diary in his hand and, you know, that whole wonderful scene in Dumbledore's office, read that very, very carefully. He even brings Harry to the point of saying, you know, Voldemort put a bit of himself in me. So Harry is already, as identified in Book 2, the what we ultimately discover, that he is something like a Horcrux. He's not an actual Horcrux, Rowling has made that clear, but he's something like a Horcrux. So that already came out in Book 2. And it's very interesting because Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, essentially the title of Book 6 is Harry Potter and Snape. But if you look at Snape in Book 2, he's still an incidental character in a way. A fun one, but he's still just one of the professors. He's not the focus of the book by any means. And you could say he's not the focus of Book 6 either, but he is, really. I mean, his influence is so strong in Book 6, and by the end of it, of course, he is, you know, he is the most interesting character in the entire series, arguably. I've often said that the Harry Potter series is actually should be entitled, you know, the Snape and the Sorcerer's Stone or Philosopher's Stone, Snape and the Chamber of Secrets, Snape, etc. But we're seeing the story of Snape through Harry's eyes. And so going back to Book 2, interesting to see what decisions did she make to put the story from Book 6 in Book 6 and put a different story in Book 2 to essentially take the Book 6 information out of her story that early and save it for later. I almost get the impression that Book 2 asks a whole lot of questions that get answered in Book 6. And if you look at the two, if you compare Book 2 and Book 6, there are so many connections between them. And I know fans have had a great time trying to list these. I've got a list in front of me. I'm just going to go through some of these just because it's so fascinating. And the more of them, you see one or two and you think, oh, well, that's fine. But the more of them that you see, the more you realize that it can't be coincidence that these two books are so connected. Probably the most obvious connection is the fact that they both are the story of a book from 50 years ago. From the original Voldemort years, the Potions book, of course, that Potions book is Snape's, and he doesn't go back 50 years, but the book itself was published 50 years ago. So both of them are books from the past, which give us information about Harry and his world in the present. There are other things. The Vanishing Cabinet, of course, first turns up in Book 2, gets damaged, and then that becomes the key for Malfoy to get past all the defenses of Hogwarts in Book 6. The Vanishing Cabinet is in both. The Cursed Opal Necklace first turns up in Book 2 and then becomes a factor in Book 6. The Hand of Glory, which turns up again first in Book 2 and is actually used by Malfoy in Book 6. And there's other kind of motifs. You've got the fact that in both books, the Harry spies on Malfoy in Nocturne Alley in Borgin and Burkes. In both of them, we have that foray following Malfoy or spying on Malfoy in Nocturne Alley. Aragog appears for the first time in Book 2 and then again in Book 6. The refilling charm, little things like this, even the refilling charm, which gets used by McGonagall to give sandwiches to Harry and Ron sitting in Snape's office after they flew the magic car, then that same charm is what Harry uses to refill the drinks when Slughorn and Hagrid are drinking after the funeral for Aragog. And even the character of Slughorn, really, there's a lot of similarities between Slughorn and Lockhart. Both of them are kind of narcissistic. They both kind of live off the achievements of others. So those two characters are very, very similar as well. And interesting, Lockhart was a Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. Slughorn was assumed to be the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher until, we got to the opening feast and found out that Snape had finally achieved that goal of his. Just some other characters. Colin Creevy in Book 2, Romilda Vane in Book 6. Both of them are these minor characters who are sort of fans of Harry and follow him around and are trying to get closer to him. And we also, obvious one, in both of them we have these memory journeys into Voldemort's past. In Book 2, it's diving into the book. In Book 6, it's diving into the pensive. But both times we have these memory journeys which give us some of Voldemort's backstory, a lot more, of course, in 6 than in 2. We have things like Crab and Goyle and Polyjuice Potion. In 2, Harry and Ron turn into Crab and Goyle, and in Book 6, Crab and Goyle turn into little girls, which I think is just hilarious and a little disturbing, quite honestly. But, again, the same sort of motif, though, used in both. We also have animals hung on a wall or on a door. In Book 2, we've got the cat hung on the wall. In Book 6, we have a snake hung on a door. Again, just this motif that repeats in both. And of course, we've got Horcruxes in both. And another little one, but just so much fun when you spot these. In Book 2, we have a floating pudding that hits somebody in the head. In Book 6, we have floating glasses of oak-matured mead, which keep tapping someone on the head. And when I first read that in Book 6, I thought, well, that's just really an odd odd image. What in the world? I realize Rowling has a delightful sense of humor, but that just seemed a kind of a strange little thing to put in there. But then, when you think about it, it's just one more little motif, one more little connection to Book 2. And you have the dark hero, anti-hero person, Voldemort in 2 and Snape in 6. Both of them have come up with a new name because they despise their Muggle father. So you've got Voldemort, Tom Riddle, becoming Lord Voldemort, and you have Snape becoming the Half-Blood Prince. And both of those are, it's kind of that same concept again. And there are other things, the fact that exams are delayed or canceled in both, that in both of them there's this huge, students are being pulled out of school for one thing or another. In Book 2, it's because of the attacks of the creature, and in Book 6, it's because Dumbledore is dead and people leave early and things. But, there's so many of those, and I'm sure this list is not exhaustive. As I'm going through Book 2 and writing the reader's guide, I'll find a lot more. I know I already have because I've been doing a lot of research already. But again, important similarities, but also important differences. As I said, Book 2 kind of asks the questions that Book 6 answers. And I think if you look at it, now look at the whole story, think about Book 5, that transformation. In Book 2, Harry does get some answers, but he just doesn't understand them. He doesn't understand what he's saying when he says, Voldemort put a bit of himself in me. But by Book 6, he has undergone that transformation and has gained that understanding, which allows him to start to put together what Horcruxes are and eventually to understand that connection that he has with Voldemort. And at the very end of Book 2, and because always when you get to the end of one of these books, you need to get these ideas into your head to move forward into the next book. You have to do that because they do connect. And I put some of that into the Reader's Guide Book 2. At the end of Book 2, Harry is transformed a little more. Remember at the end of Book 1, he switches right back to being a Muggle. He's just totally Muggleized again at the end of Book 1, to the point where he doesn't even imagine that when the rescue comes that it's actually a rescue. He just tells them, oh, go, please tell them at Hogwarts that I can't come back. At the end of Book 2, he is beginning to become a little bit more independent, a little bit more his own person. He's not transformed at all completely yet, but he is definitely changing. And part of it is he's just growing up. If you think about the fact that in Book 1 he couldn't lift his trunk to get it on the train, whereas in the beginning of Book 3 he just hauls that thing down the steps and walks out the door with it. But at the end of Book 2, we can see that he is not going to ever be that cowering, sad little boy that he was even at the end of Book 1, and that transformation is starting. Now, the transformation in our eyes, in his eyes, and in the world's eyes maybe is transforming toward being the action hero, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. One thing that I just wanted to mention too, this is still just bothering me, not bothering me, but it's just tantalizing me is a better way to put it. Trying to figure out how Dobby knows what he knows. Because at the beginning of book two, he knows way more than he should. He's warning Harry of a plot which frankly doesn't even exist at that point. How does he know this? How does he put this together? And I think really you have to look at the character of Dobby, and you have to look at that and say, jumping out of here a minute, but one thing that I love is that you realize that in book two and in book six, there's a midnight conversation with house elves in the hospital wing after a Quidditch injury. I mean, both times. Anyway, going back to where I was, Dobby, the character of Dobby is intentionally written to seem sort of helpless and pathetic, kind of like Neville in a way. But if you look at what Dobby is capable of, even while he is still under the control of Malfoy, when you see what he is capable of, the power that that little elf has, it's quite amazing. But so is there something about Dobby the house elf which we're going to, you know, kind of tease out as things go by? What kind of power does he have? I'm hoping that when Rowling is writing her notes for Pottermore for Book 2, that we get more information about Dobby and about house elves and about their capabilities and their powers. Probably we won't, not in Book 2, because if you look at the way things go on Pottermore, if you click on a character who's in a scene, you only get information based on what you would know that far in the books. You don't get a lot of future stuff, so we probably have to wait until further in the series to get full details about Dobby. But I'm curious to see what more she has to tell us about that character, because some of the things he does, the power that house elves have, is quite amazing. Before we kind of wrap it up, one more little thing I wanted to mention, and this is just came out of reading, and one of those things that pops out at me is Hagrid says at one point that the Defense Against the Dark Arts job is, and this is his quote, they're beginning to think it's jinxed. Okay, beginning to think? It's been 35 years that they've had to have a new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher every year. 35 years. That's how long it was since that conversation between Dumbledore and Tom Riddle, when Tom asked for the teaching job and then cursed the position. So after 35 years, I don't think they're just beginning to think. I don't know if Hagrid is just downplaying it or whether it's just never clicked for him, but anyone who's paying attention has got to realize that there's something going on with that. Well, moving, this pretty much takes us to the end of this episode. I thought about episode 7. I thought after I'd written all my notes, I thought, oh man, this is episode 7. I should probably talk about how important the number 7 is in the Harry Potter series, how it's a magical number. And but I'd already written all the notes, so I didn't do that. And I also thought it's just shortly, couple days, less than a week after September 1, and I should have probably, you know, talked about the fact that everyone is heading off to Hogwarts right about now. In fact, it would be the first week of Hogwarts, which means that everybody's getting used to their classes and sorting things out and things like that, and the first years are getting lost and can't find their way and all that kind of thing. And I would assume that Quidditch tryouts will be next week. So if you happen to be in the Highlands of Scotland and you happen to be in the area, and yes, I did kind of track down Hogwarts as well, but if you happen to be around there, you might want to just drop in and see if they need anybody on the Quidditch teams, especially if you've had a chance to get sorted in Pottermore and know which house you're supposed to be in. So that wraps things up for Episode 7. Thanks again to Harry and the Potters for letting me use the music that I use for the theme on here. If you want to check out more information, go to the Harry Potter Lexicon website, which is www.hp-lexicon.org, and you'll find the podcast page there. There's a link on the Lexicon pages to the podcast, and I put show notes there and details and things. If you want to contact me, my email is steve.lexicon@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter. That's lexicon_Steve. And you can also, there's also a Facebook fan page, and I'm not going to try to give you that whole link right now because it's huge, but I'll put the link on the show notes and things like this so you can go there. There's, again, some discussions going on, and I like to put some trivia in there and things like that. Remember that to check out the Reader's Guide to Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone on Kindle and soon on the Nook, and hopefully soon on other platforms too as I get that formatted for that. Thank you for all the emails that I've gotten, messages that I've gotten supporting this podcast. I really appreciate that. That makes a huge difference. Because when you sit here and you're, you know, staring at your screen and talking basically to yourself, it's good to know that people are listening and appreciating and the information and enjoying just kind of sitting down together for 45 minutes and talking about Harry Potter. I also very much appreciate those who posted reviews on iTunes. It's great to read those and to know that people are enjoying this podcast. So that's about it for this time around. This is Steve Vandrark of the Harry Potter Lexicon kind of apparating out of here. And as always, thanks for listening.